We're looking at that passage. I looked at a list last week of about 40 kings of Israel and Judah over a period of 350 years. And if you were looking at the list, I wonder how many you might tick as having perhaps better than a half decent kind of reign as kings. When I looked at them, not many, I have to say. Not many. Now, just like us, of course, they were all sinners. They all needed saving. They were all a disappointment to God at particular times, as even those of us who are saved are. But fair play, because they loved the Lord, there were a few of them had a go. Yes, I was one of them here. Yeah, they have a go at honouring God. Last week's theme was honouring God, if you remember. So tonight in 2 Chronicles 14, Asa takes on the real enemy of God's people, sin, and his own enemy, sin. And the title is Deal With It. And I've chosen that as a title as opposed to making a deal with sin, which we can also do. So deal with sin. Now, I don't know about you. I know, I think, three verses from 2 Chronicles. One is in chapter 7, if my people, many of you know that. The other two are from the reign of Asa. One is in the next chapter. The Lord is with you when you are with him. And if you seek him, you'll be found by you, which is great. And the other one is in the following chapter, chapter 16, still in the reign of Asa. The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth. You know that one? Seeking to strengthen the hearts of those who are committed to him. Great verses that have helped me over the years. Anyway, the kingdom is split, if you remember. You've got Rehoboam in Judah. After him, Abijah. And both of them, not much shape, you have to say, on either of them. Then comes Asa, who reigns for maybe 41 years. His boy then, Jehoshaphat, for about 25. And those two are in the best of a bad bunch, you have to say. And tonight, Asa deals with sin and seems to deal with it straight away. He was the leader, and therefore he had the opportunity to influence a lot of people. The definition of a leader, I suppose, is you can influence other people. Now, you may be a leader at work, you may not. You may be a leader in something in church, you may not. But we all have an opportunity to influence others. Unless you live in a cave somewhere on your own, we all have an opportunity to influence people out there and in here. I remember doing a mission many years ago in a particular church, 3 or 4 days, and there was a lovely guy called Gary, and he was a sleeves rolled up sort of fella. He helped me with lots of the nuts and bolts of what I was doing there. He's very friendly, but none of his family were interested, and none of his family came to church. And one day, talking to the pastor told me this about Gary. He said, "I think Gary's family have rejected the package as they see it in him." And I've never forgotten it. You know, the pastor was suggesting that what Gary said was fine, and his attitude in church was fine, but at home, he was not a great witness. At home, wasn't what he said was wrong. I'm sure what he said was in their faces, but somehow they'd rejected the gospel because they'd rejected Gary. And you know, we all can affect people we rub shoulders with, for good or bad, can't we? And Gary sadly had affected his family for ill, for bad. What about you? People who rub shoulders with at work or at home? Perhaps you've got non-Christian friends or Christian friends, and you can have a good effect or a bad effect on them. See, Asa used his opportunity. When the chance came, he really did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord and had a great effect on the people. So maybe you absolutely believe the truth of the gospel, but when people look at you, what do they see? What do people see? See, Asa led from the front, away from sin, and towards the Lord. Tremendous. Away from sin, towards righteousness. He fought sin. At times he fought sinners, but he fought sin. And remarkably, we read that there was peace for 10 years. Now, that might not sound a tremendous amount, but when you think that just like today, they were surrounded by their enemies, they still are. If you look at Israel, you can hard to find it on the map. It's tiny. And all around their enemies, same then. Enemies, you know some of them, like last week, the Philistines. 10 years of peace was miraculous, astonishing. But Asa acknowledges they had the peace because God had given it to them. Why? Because they sought the Lord. That's what was on the reading there. Then after 10 years, Zerah comes with a mighty army. You know, the Greg and Kendrick chorus we sometimes sing, though trials will come, be strong, don't run. What's next? Lift up your eyes. That's what Asa does. He lifts up his eyes. He doesn't panic. I'm tremendous at panicking in a crisis. I'm absolutely useless in a crisis. I panic easily, to my shame. He doesn't panic. He doesn't despair. Nor does he rush into worldly schemes, dishing out the cash so that other mercenaries will come. He looks to the Lord. He prays to God. And wonderfully, the Lord answers. Asa knows more than money and more than men, he needs God. You look at verse 11. When Asa cries out to the Lord, he goes on to say, Lord, there's no one like you. There's nobody like you. You are in a class of your own. We rely on your name, he says. And the answer comes in verse 12, and the Lord strikes down these enemies. Now, the estimates are that the Cushites, when they came, probably had, what did the reading say, thousands and thousands, maybe a million. So they're outnumbered 2-1. Big thing when they got chariots and you haven't. You got, what is it, Benjamin had little shields. But the Lord is in it. You look at verse 5. What did Asa do to fight sin? He removed the high places and the incense altars from all the cities of Judah. And then he builds these fortified cities. So he acts straight away. In verse 2, he's positive. And Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord. But sometimes that involves doing negative things, or what seem to be negative things. And that's verse 3. He removed the altars of the foreign gods, high places, broke down the sacred pillars, and cut down the wooden images. Now, there was a big argument on the radio last week. This mountain of ivory that they're burning. You know, people saying, well, you know, it's worth £100 million. And the country is poor. You know, they could use that money. But they believe, the government there, that what we are doing, yeah, it's awful to burn all that ivory. But they believe in doing that, they are protecting the elephants. So they believe there's a higher motive. Well, here's Asa. You know, if you'd seen him with a sledgehammer going in, smashing those things, you'd say, who's he? Let's get the police. What's this bloke doing? But he's doing something that is violent because he wants to get rid of all the foreign gods and therefore discourage the people from serving foreign gods. And then verse 4, he commanded Judah. Well, he's the king. He can't. You can't command me. I can't command you. But he commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their fathers, and to observe the law and the commandments. And amazingly, verse 7, they have peace because, he says, we've sought God and he's given us rest. It wasn't a fluke that they had peace. God had given it to them. And he reminds them in verse 11 that they were powerless. Verse 11, he cries out to the Lord and says, Lord, it is nothing to you for help, whether with many or those who have no power, and that's them. They have no power. They are powerless. And he cries out to the Lord. Now then, I read this week in my quiet time, I do encourage you, if you don't systematically read the Bible, you should. You should read it systematically. In the first church we were in, there was a lovely man, lovely man. But I discovered he knew certain chunks of the Bible very well, but he'd never read it all. He'd been a Christian 25 years. He was a lovely man, and definitely, I'd say, a Christian. But there were passages that I was struggling with him. I'd ask him, he'd never read it. Oh, he knew Psalm 23, Isaiah 53, John 3, you know, but he didn't systematically read. Well, as I was reading this, we came to Psalm 18, and, you know, I called to the Lord. You know, it could have been Asa's words. It wasn't, right? It was David. But I called to the Lord, who was worthy of praise. He rescued me from my foes, which were too strong for me. Then I read Jeremiah 24. I'll give them a heart to know me. Yes, yes, sir. A heart. It's a heart thing. They'll be my people, says the Lord through Jeremiah. They'll be my people. I'll be their God. Then I read in Mark 12, Jesus pointing out the most important command. Now, they're all important. But he says the most important is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Well, that's Asa. Yeah, he loves the Lord, and that's why he's doing what he's doing. In Psalm 18, again, the author says, he trains my hands for battle. He'll train your hands for battle. You've got to fight. The Lord will train your hands for battle. But if you're not prepared to fight, if you want to do a deal with sin, negotiate, manage it, well, the Lord's not interested in you managing your sin. You've got to kill your sin. You've got to fight it. Now, really, having quoted all that, I could just stop there and say, well, there we are. There's enough for you now to think about on the life of Asa, as in just these 11 or 12 verses and the bits I've given you from Psalm 18. I could say, well, there we are. You can go home now and think about it. But can I trust you to do that? Unlikely, isn't it? Unlikely. So I just want to look in a bit more depth at what it means for Asa and for you and for me to fight sin. To fight sin. Now, I don't mean necessarily fighting sin in somebody else. Easy to point out their sins. They're glaring, aren't they? You think sometimes, well, why can't they see their sin? Look at them. It's just talk about those creatures that were glowing that Hannah was showing us this morning. You see some people, you think, well, dear me, how can't they see their sin? But yeah, okay, yeah, there's the plank and the speck. I know all that as well. But I mean your own sin. Fighting sin in your own backyard first. Now, there is a time to get rid of the splinter, but you've got to deal with the plank first, haven't you? You've got to deal with a big plank sticking out of your own head before you go on and deal with. So, deal with it. That's my title. Asa, when he looked at sin, his motto here in this chapter was, he's going to deal with it. And you've got to deal with it. I think we'd been here about 6 months, I think. Anniversary today. Yeah, it is. 16 years today, May the 1st. We'd been living on the hill. We were renting in Mayhill there for about 6 months, I think, and then the church felt we should be living in the manse. Somebody was already living in it. And they moved out, and we needed redecorating, if you remember, some of you. When we eventually moved in, there was a big notice on the gas fire. There's a small leak, do not use. So we got an expert in. Never forgotten what he said. Oh, you can use it, he said. There is a leak, but it's an acceptably small leak. Now, I don't know about you, I don't fancy going to bed in the night thinking there's an acceptable amount of gas leaking into my house. Could you rest and say, it's okay, it's acceptable? But when it comes to, I bet you wouldn't, would you? Would you? But when it comes to sin, we're very comfortable allowing an acceptable amount of sin into our lives, aren't we? Which does a lot more damage than a whiff of gas. You know, I read years ago an author criticizing the modern church. He said, Christians are behaving like tourists. And obviously, I assume he meant, you know, laid back, casual, not in a rush, on holiday, we're tourists. No rush. We're there for a good time. We're there for a me time. That's what people go on holiday, isn't it? You know, sometimes you've got kids. It's not so much me, it's more them, I know. But is that your attitude? There's a bit of a legend now that in a ministers' conference in Bala 40 years ago or something, Lloyd Jones interrupted the prayer meeting of the ministers praying and shouted, you're praying like people on holiday. Well, I assume that's what he meant, like tourists, casual, laid back. Take it or leave it, Lord. See, some of you don't drink, you don't smoke, you don't swear, you don't download dodgy stuff. Whatever goes on in your mind, is it helpful to God? Does he like it? Does he feel comfortable? I always remember a lady who was a church member. I think she was a Christian, actually. And I remember her talking about her early years as a Christian. And she said, I mean, it was nothing to do with love for God. But at least we didn't take drugs. I said, okay, you didn't take drugs. Great, you didn't take drugs. But this is important, the first part of that, isn't it? You did it, but legalists don't take drugs or smoke or drink or sleep around, do they? Then I remember on a camp we did for students many years ago, a girl who was studying in Oxbridge coming up saying that suddenly she'd realized that night that she was a good girl. She said, you know, I don't swear. I don't sleep around. You know, she's a student, man, in the 90s in Oxford, I think it was. I suppose everybody was just about to sleep around. So there we are, she's a good girl, she reads her Bible, she's in church, she's in the CU, she doesn't sleep around. But she said, I've seen tonight that it's got nothing to do with me loving him. It was just, she was a legalist. She was towing the line. And suddenly she was convicted. Now what about you? If you were a good boy or a good girl, you have some idea what that means. Has it got anything to do with love for the Lord? You know, when Jan Hus was on trial for his life, and they burnt him, if you remember, when they took him on in court, he said, I will take my case to a higher court. And we know what he meant, even though that meant being burnt. See, we're not tourists. Somebody made the point in that article that I was on about, we're at war. Now, do you believe you're at war? But if we're at war, and I think officially, because we've got Ephesians 6 about the armor, we have to say, well, nobody needs armor unless we're at war. So we're at war. But then somebody said in a book I read years ago, we're at war, but we behave more like prisoners of war than commandos. And I've met loads of Christians like that. I remember a dear lady telling me, my pastor, it was one of these churches where they had a high pulpit, you know. I see my pastor walking up the steps, defeat written all over his face every Sunday. Now, he is a man behaving like a POW rather than a commando. You know, then that man in the book reminded me, the preacher's job, this is where now, oh, dear me, why did I? Well, I didn't have any choice. The Lord called me, did I? And I'm not complaining. But when he says the preacher's job is to turn an audience into an army. Well, how am I doing? Here you are. How do you think I'm doing? Not very well. How are you doing? Not very well. To turn a congregation into combat. You know, one of my favorite scenes in films, I love films mainly because they give me illustrations, but my favorite illustration is in the Elliot Ness film, The Untouchables, where the FBI young fella, Elliot Ness, has gone to Chicago to crack Capone, you know, because everybody's tried, and of course the police are corrupt, and the politicians are corrupt, and the mayor's corrupt, and everybody's corrupt. And of course young Elliot Ness comes, and he's shown this door, and he's told that behind the door now is all Capone's men making the illicit booze. And he says, oh, they're there, well, let's go. Just pick up the axe, let's smash the door, and let's go. And then he's warned by the old policeman, who say, well, just to warn you now, the minute you go through that door, it's war. Capone's not going to like it. It's going to be war. And I love the illustration. It's so powerful because the moment you became a Christian, devil declared war on you. Up till then, he had you, and you got on well with him, and even though you didn't realize, perhaps he was there. But he had you. And now you've defected to the Lord's side. But it's war. Now, is there any evidence in your life that you're at war? Is there a fight going on? Asa removed. He smashed down. He cut down. This was violent. He did something. I was reminded this week of Tozer. In the Christian's heart, there's a throne and a cross. Don't sit on the throne with your tinsel crown. As proud as Caesar, get on the cross. And I was reminded of that, and I was just thinking, yeah, and that's it. This is so easy, and easy for me to remember the quote and quote it, and people go, oh, yeah, that's powerful. And then I got in the car. The Lord was obviously after me for this. I got in the car, and I put the radio on, and as soon as I put it on, I just started the engine, and it came on, and it was halfway through a David Bowie song. And you know the words in the song? It came straight on. I knew the Lord was after me and speaking to me, because the words in the song was, I will be king, and you will be queen. And I thought, yeah, that's it, because I want to be king all the time. I want to get off the cross, because that's not nice. It hurts. I want to get back on the throne. And it'll take a miracle of the Holy Spirit to shift me and you. This is why we are as we are. This is why we're not given the impression we're in a war and we're in combat. This is why we do give the impression we're much more comfortable in our carpet slippers than in our combat boots. You know, I read Jeremiah 25 this week. For 23 years, dear, you know, to read Jeremiah, my heart goes out to him. For 23 years I've spoken the word of the Lord, but you have not listened. Turn now from your evil practices. But that before he talks about turning from their practices, he says, turn now from your evil ways. So he's thinking. It's got to, if you're going to fight sin, you've got to fight it in you. Because our ways, this is the problem. This is why repentance is first and foremost a change of mind, thinking, before we do anything. Otherwise, we just legalists. I don't do that. I'll cut that out. I won't do that. And the other things, yeah, cut them down. But you've got to think right. Now, I remember in a previous church, the first person who changed their mind. She was already a Christian. But she changed her mind. And I could, it's a very long story. And it's a wonderful story to me. And if you want to know it, I can tell you again. But it involved an illustration I used that had been given to me the day before, of church life, where everybody's sitting in chairs facing a white wall, and on the wall are all these things that are true about the Lord. And people are sitting there, and some of them are set in rhyme, so they sing them, and some of them are just verses, and they all nod and say amen. But actually, in this vision that was given me, the Lord is there, but everybody's facing the wall. And they say, oh, isn't he wonderful? And then an old man comes in and says, he's there! And I turned, you see, in this vision, I turned. And I saw him. And I tried to shout to everybody else, and nobody was interested. They all said, hush, hush, hush. Look, we're trying to sing. Look, we concentrate on the words. Leave us alone. And I shared that illustration, and an old lady came up to me. And I always remember what she shook my hand, and she said, I've just turned my chair around. Well, tremendous. And she had. She had. Have you turned see something of who he is? If you love him, see? If you love him. You know, if you're trying to live the Christian life without Christ, that's boring. Deadly boring. J.C. Ryle said, kill sin or it will kill you. Are you dealing with sin or are you doing a deal with sin? You know, again in Psalm 18, one of my favorite verses, he parted the heavens and came down. And I love that because it reminds me every time of those times. Maybe they're rare, but have you known those times when he's just come? He's near. Sometimes out of nowhere, out of the blue, it seemed. You're aware of the presence of the living God. You've known perhaps suddenly his approval, that he's got his arms around him. He's saying, go on. I'm with you. Don't worry. You're mine. No, those times when you've been obedient and your knees were knocking, but out of love for him, you've obeyed. And now, immediately, it seems, the time has become precious because you know he's his pleasure. And at those moments, you gladly die for him. You would. You die for him because it can't, on earth, this can't, it can't, there's nothing better than this on earth. Nothing better. This is it. He's near, he's pleased with me, he's smiling upon me, he's telling me how much he loves me. Now, maybe, surely you've known some, even if they fleet him, haven't you known anything like that? When you've loved praising him, and you've known that he's loved you praising him, you've known it. You know, I came across an astonishing truth this week in a science book. Scientists estimate, right? They don't know, but they're estimating. That however many words you've spoken in your life, and I've spoken in my life, in fact, how many words everybody who's ever lived has spoken in their life. Can you imagine adding it up? Right? You need a big calculator for that, wouldn't you? How many words everybody's ever spoken who's ever lived on planet Earth? There are more stars up there than that. Right? That's the estimate. I was thinking, what? What? Why? Why are there so many? We don't know the names of, can't say half of them, we don't know the names of a fraction of them. What are they doing there? Why are they there? And the answer is to remind me, it's not about me. It's all about him. What are they doing there? You know, John Piper's thing, I always remember 20 odd years ago when I first read him, He said, you take a teaspoonful of water out of a lake. You think, oh, there's nice fresh water. And then you've got a friend in the microbiology lab or something, and they take it and they scrutinize it, they analyze it, and they put it under an electron microscope or something, and they find millions of living things in it. And Piper says, what are they doing there? Answer, bringing glory to God. What are they there for? We can't see them. If you drink them, you can't taste them. What are they doing? They're bringing him glory, because it's not about us in the end. It's all about him, which is why Jesus says the most important command is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. And therefore loving him is the best. In the 90s when that chorus came out, that's got the All I Once Held Dear, when it comes to the Kitgan part, the chorus part, All I Once Held Dear, you know, is the verse, then knowing you, you're the best. I remember some theological nitpicker saying, well, that's bad theology. He can't be the best because there's nobody else in the same league as him to compare him with. He's not the best of the best in the Premier League or the best whatever. I thought, yeah, okay, fair enough. But he is the best because he's the best in any league, all the leagues. You're the best. And loving him is the best. Now, I'm suggesting to you this, and this is astonishing and shocking. It shouldn't be, but it is. That I'm telling you tonight that he is the best. He is better than anything you can possibly imagine. And most of you, right, most of you, you will ignore it and say, oh yeah, he's great. But in practice, you don't believe it. He's better than anything the world can give. Now, people tell me that when they go to Adele concerts, that everybody ends up weeping. It's so moving, apparently, the way she delivers the song live. And got blokes, hardened blokes, and say, well, I go because my missus likes Adele. And he ends up crying. So, but loving him is better than any concert. It's better than the best sex you've ever had. It's better than the best movie you've ever seen. Better than the best book you've ever read. Better than your team winning the league or the cup. Better than iPads and Facebook. Better than fun with your family. Better than the most enjoyable holiday destination. But most of you, though, you would nod and say, yeah, that must be true. Your hearts betray you, though. And Tozer says, whatever's done, no matter how biblical, whatever's done without heart is done in the dark. And that is awful, see. Because it's just a shell. That's what legalism is. It's a shell. When he offers the best, and loving him is the best, that's what drove Acer on you. What am I saying tonight? What does God say? Don't settle for anything less than the best. Loving him is the best. And you say, yeah, yeah, I know. But you don't know. That's the thing. In his presence is fullness of joy. What does that mean? In his pleasure is the best pleasure you can have. I'm sure some of you you've had good times, haven't you? You've enjoyed yourself. But you can't live off other people's experiences of God. When you read the book or somebody says something amazing in prayer meeting, and say, wow, that's great. You can end up trying to live off their experience. It's no good, man. You've got to love him. And I can't make you love him, and you can't make yourself love him. In his pleasure, in you loving him, is the best the world can ever, ever offer. That's why McShane prayed that prayer, Lord, make me as holy as a saved sinner can be. He didn't mean, Lord, make me holy and make me miserable. Which is what we think. To be holy, well, obviously you deny yourself that, there's nothing much left. So you're pretty gloomy and you walk around in a holy huddle with other people who are miserable and wear black as well. That's not it, is it? I read yesterday, Mark chapter 14, and the woman, probably Mary is it, who anoints Jesus, you know? And that powerful, amazing, beautiful, but powerful phrase that Jesus says about her, she did what she could. Asa did what he could. Are you doing what you could? Doing what you can? An old saint, probably a Puritan, said this, and this is really strong. If you don't know something of heaven before you die, you'll never get there afterwards. Now that's very strong. And I don't think I entirely agree with it, but I know what he's saying. Remember Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century, where somebody told him of a young woman in New Haven. This is what they said. There's a young woman in New Haven who knows the delights of God. Sarah, he married her, didn't he? Who knows the delights of God. Now, you'll never know the delights of God if you're still delighting in your sin. You can't. Because he hates it. He won't come. See, we want the experience, we want the blessing, but we don't want to let go. You've got to let go. Asa dealt with it in this chapter. Are you going to deal with it tonight? So that the words of your mouth and the meditation of all your thoughts are pleasing in his sight.